With me now is poet Gwendolyn Brooks, who in 1950 won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, the first black person to receive this award. In her autobiography, Report from Part One, Brooks wrote, quote, "When I was a child, it did not occur to me even once that the black in which I was encased would be considered one day beautiful. Considered beautiful and called beautiful by great groups, I had always considered it beautiful," she wrote. Gwendolyn Brooks was born in Topeka, Kansas in 1917. She grew up in Chicago, where she still lives. In 1968, she succeeded Carl Sandburg as the Poet Laureate of Chicago. She's written about 15 books, and her poems have been widely anthologized. She's been awarded over 40 honorary doctorates. Gwendolyn Brooks is in Philadelphia to give this year's Marion Moore poetry reading at Bryn Mawr College. That's this evening at Bryn Mawr College at 8:30 in Goodhart Hall, and the reading is free and open to the public. Gwendolyn Brooks, welcome to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure
to meet you. Thank you very much. You haven't given me enough glory, however. I'm Poet Laureate of the whole state of Illinois.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, before we talk about your poems, I'd love it if you could open with a short reading for us.
All right. Well, perhaps I'll read your favorite, We Real Cool. Most young people, if they know my poetry at all, know me by that very short poem. And it has had its problems, as I've told many audiences. It has been banned in a couple of places. Banned because of the word jazz in it, which was considered a sexual reference. I don't think this audience will consider it especially a sexual reference. The pool players, seven at the Golden Shovel. We real cool, we left school, we lurk light, we strike straight, we sing sin, we then gin, we jazz June, we die soon. You see, I'm sure you see, I was thinking of music. I have another poem called Riot, which I would like to offer you. Many people, I'm sure, when they see riots on television and pictures of riots in the newspapers, wonder what those little black people are up to now. Aren't they ever satisfied? To such people, I would like to quote something that was frequently said by Martin Luther King. A riot is the language of the unheard. And I stuck that up here at the top of this poem. I wrote it because I saw a half-page photograph of young rioters coming down our Madison Street in Chicago right after Martin Luther King was assassinated. And it was a photograph of such fierce-looking young people. And I wondered how a young white liberal or an old white liberal would respond to such a confrontation, such an announcement. And I decided to call my liberal John Cabot, which seemed to me to be a perfect name for him. And I'm sure it will put many of your listeners in mind of that old saying about Boston, Boston, where the Lowells speak only to the Cabots, and the Cabots speak only to God. It made me think, as I remembered it, that an ideal name for my hero is John Cabot. John Cabot, out of Wilma, once a Wycliffe, all white blue rose below his golden hair, wrapped richly in right linen and right wool, almost forgot his jaguar and light bluff. Almost forgot Grand Tully, which is the best thing that ever happened to Scotch. Almost forgot the sculpture at the Richard Gray and Distelheim, the kidney pie at Maxim's, the grenadine de boeuf at Maison Henri. Because the Negroes were coming down the street. Because the poor were sweaty and unpretty, not like two dainty Negroes in Winnetka, and they were coming toward him in rough ranks, in seas, in windsweep. They were black and loud,
and not detainable and not discreet. Gross, gross, Catoué Grossier, John Cabot itched instantly beneath the nourished white that told his story of glory to the world. Don't let it touch me, the blackness. Lord, he whispered to any handy angel in the sky. But in a thrilling announcement, on it drove and breathed on him and touched him. In that breath, the fume of pigfoot, chitterling and cheek chilly, malign mocked John. And in terrific touch, old averted doubt jerked forward decently, cried, Cabot, John, you are a desperate man, and the desperate die expensively today. John Cabot went down in the smoke and fire, and broken glass and blood, and he cried, Lord, forgive these niggers that know not what they do. A sweet little non-controversial poem that I'd like to offer you is a welcome song for Laini and Zynga. We see so many terrible things on television. We see piles of bodies. Blood seems to be running throughout the universe. And sometimes we get quite uneasy. I'm optimistic, however. I feel that as long as there are new people coming into the world every day, there has to be some hope. Hello, little sister, coming through the rim of the world. We are here to meet you, and to mold and to maintain you. With excited eyes we see you. With welcoming ears we hear the clean sound of new language, the language of Laini and Zynga. We love and we receive you as our own. I think I'll pause right there and give you a chance to ask me, when did you start writing poetry?
Gwendolyn Brooks is my guest if you're just joining us. And she'll be reading this evening at Bryn Mawr College at 8:30 in Goodhart Hall. It seems that I think most poets are read only by other poets. And you seem to me...
I hope that's not true.
I think it is true, actually, but... I think that you're one of the poets in America who's read by a pretty broad audience. How do you think you've found your audience? Since really, let's face it, not that many people go looking for poetry.
Well, I keep meeting people who say, I love poetry. Sometimes, of course, I meet students who say that they distrust it because they've had it analyzed to death in classrooms by unimaginative teachers. I can understand that. But I think that some of that great interest on the part of young people that we experienced in the late 60s is still alive. I still find it on campuses. I visit a good many campuses every year, and I meet many, many young people who are writing poetry. They don't say that they want to be poets, inevitably, but they enjoy reading it, and they enjoy expressing their feelings poetically.
As you mentioned, many young people know your poem, We Real Cool, and that's been widely anthologized, and
yeah,
a lot of people are introduced to that in
much.
School. From people who know you through that poem and who are introduced to you through that poem, what do you think of the way they've been introduced to poetry in schools? Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I don't know exactly how they have been taught that poem. Chiefly, I believe it's merely read to them, or they are allowed to read it. And they like it because I believe it has a little of the street sound that makes some of those young people who came
forth in the late 60s, so very popular. People like Nikki Giovanni and Etheridge Knight and Haki Madhubuti, formerly known as Don L. Lee, Mari Evans, and Audre Lorde, too, is very well known. She doesn't have a consistent street sound, but you know where she's coming from when you read her excellent poetry.
Was there poetry like that when you were starting to write? Did you ever feel that to write a poem you had to use formal, dressed-up language?
Well, when I was 16, I ran into a little book called Caroling Dusk, which had the poems of Langston Hughes and Sterling Brown, County Cullen, Claude McKay, and other people who knew black people very well, being black themselves. And I was very happy to find that blacks could write and be published. That was my first. No, it was my second introduction to that reality, because Paul Laurence Dunbar was a household idol in my family. And Paul Laurence Dunbar's most popular poems were written in what was then called dialect. Today, most of us prefer to speak of blackening English rather than dialect. By that I mean, and you probably know, this is for somebody in the audience who doesn't know, that many young blacks some years ago, 10, 15 years ago, decided they weren't going to move to Africa after all. They had thought they might, many of them, but they decided they were going to stay right here. But they wanted to be easy in their everyday language. They wanted to feel familiar and comfortable. So they blacken English. And I refer you to such a poem as "But He Was Cool" by Haki. Well, you'll find it in many black anthologies under the name Don L. Lee. And, of course, many, many of Nikki's older poems are blackened English.
Were you ever criticized for writing that way instead of writing in standard English?
It's just the other way around. The only poem that I have written that can be called streetwise at all is We Real Cool. Everything else has been written in what I understood to be standard English, which is a phrase I despise, as many of my brothers and sisters do. I'm sure you could understand why we despise it. It's because, well, whose standards, you want to ask? Whose standards?
As someone who spends a good part of her time with language, what difference did it make for you when people started using the word black instead of Negro?
Oh, I love that. And I instantly began to persuade all of my family. By that I mean the great black family of men, women, and children all over the world, to use that word because it unifies. In fact, I have a poem called Primer for Blacks, which, if you'll excuse me, I'll recite now. It speaks to that very fact, and I'd like to introduce a reading of it with a paragraph from the works of Haki. He said, "We have bloods who are so heavy that they are now in their post-black period. We'll tell you that they've been through that black thing, that they were black last year or year before that. Can you imagine a white saying he's been through that white thing, that he's now in his post-white period?" So I like an audience to mull over that while I read Primer for Blacks. Blackness is a title, is a preoccupation, is a commitment blacks are to comprehend, and in which you are to perceive your glory. The conscious shout of all that is white
is it's great to be white. The conscious shout of the slackin' black is it's great to be white. Thus all that is white has white strength and yours. The word black has geographic power, pulls everybody in. Blacks here, blacks there, blacks wherever they may be. And remember, you blacks, what they told you. Remember your education. One drop maketh a brand new black. Oh, mighty drop. And because they have given us kindly so many more of our people, blackness stretches over the land. Blackness, the black of it, the rust red of it, the milk and cream of it, the tan and yellow tan of it, the deep brown, middle brown, high brown of it, the olive and ochre of it. Blackness marches on, the huge, the pungent object of our prime outride is to comprehend, to salute, and to love the fact that we are black, which is our ultimate reality, which is the lone ground from which our meaningful metamorphosis, from which our prosperous staccato group or individual can rise. Self-shriveled blacks begin with gaunt and marvelous concession. You are our costume and our fundamental bone. All of you, you colored ones, you Negro ones, those of you who proudly cry, I'm a half Indian. Those of you who proudly screech, I've got the blood of George Washington in my veins. All of you, you proper blacks, you half blacks, you wish I weren't blacks, niggeros and niggerines, you. Well, now that poem is quite frankly called A Preachment, and it's in a little book of three preachments. Of course, now all my poems don't sound like that. What I'm struggling for is a sound that will enable me to take a poem into a tavern, which is what I used to do with those young poets in the late 60s. Those were great days, the very greatest of my life. In a tavern, your poem, if you dare to offer a poem in a tavern, your poem must be immediately accessible, readily accessible. I don't want to say easy to understand, but it must seem relevant to the people there because they have not come there for poetry. So if you're going to offer them poetry, it's got to be something they can eat.
You were already a pretty established poet in the late 60s when the movement that you're referring to started both in poetry and just in radical politics. I think a lot of people feel really threatened when they've already built a reputation and have a personality in their field, and then something really radical happens, and they might even be considered part of the establishment. But you obviously did not feel threatened by it.
It was exhilarating to see what was happening all around me. Young black people standing up straight and tall, you know, and feeling that they were valid at last and that they were going to do something to change things. Well, all the changes they wanted didn't happen, but I feel that the black spirit will never be able to accept what it accepted in the 30s and 40s and 50s, just because of what happened in the 60s. So that was positive. As for being threatened, I simply did not think in such terms. Those young people taught me so much that I needed to know about
our society, for instance. And they introduced me to books that I wouldn't have read otherwise. Books like Ferdinand Lundberg's The Rich and the Super Rich. You probably know that. And the autobiography of Malcolm X, The Wretched of the Earth. So it was a very important time for me. And it's interesting, though, I had to smile when you said that you could have felt threatened. Here was all this newness, and perhaps they looked upon you as part of the establishment. And that's quite possible, I think, that they might have when they first met me. But it didn't take them long to find out that at least I wasn't a conscious tool of the establishment. And then we had great times. They come over to my house, flop on the floor, argue and argue. And as I said, we go to taverns and jails and sometimes just read our poetry out in the park. Pretty soon we had an audience.
Was there any generational split between yourself and
there
the younger
poets?
There
really wasn't in those times. Women older than myself were accepted as family. And there weren't these fancy little proud divisions. I mean, if you were a teacher, that's what you did. That had nothing to do with your guts and your blackness. If you were a garbage collector, that's what you did. You still sat in the room with the factory workers, the miners, the steel workers, the teachers, the city workers who got their money from City Hall. But it was certainly a great time for familiness.
We're talking about this in past tense. Do you think that that kind of spirit is still around?
Well, for instance, in those times, I was just thinking about that as I came into this building. I passed by two black men, and I looked at each one to see if there was anything about to happen between us. In those times, you wouldn't have dreamed of passing by your brother, your sister, without saying, "Hi, brother, hi, sister." And you really don't get much of that these days. People are suspicious of each other. They're very wary, cautious. Those times might come back to some extent, however, because there's a lot of trouble now, and trouble does tend to bring people together, don't you think?
I suppose. Or make you scared, one or the other, depending on your temperament. What do you think of rap records?
Oh, I love them, yes. Do you remember, again, back in those times, the last poets,
mm-hmm.
you heard any of their
sure,
records?
Sure, yeah.
And pretty close to that now is the spirit of the reggae singers and poets. And I met some of them. I just came from England a few weeks ago. And I was over there to help judge a poetry competition, the Arvon Foundation poetry competition. And I met, for instance, Linton Kwesi Johnson. You ever heard of him?
No.
He's very famous over there, young black fellow of 30. And he has some marvelous reggae albums and books of reggae-type poetry. So that is very strong over there.
You are, as we established before, the poet laureate of the state of Illinois. Is there a job description or anything that goes with that title? Are there things you're expected to do?
Well, I wondered about that, too. And I knew if I was going to be asked to compose poems to honor sanitary installations, I would not be interested. But they tell me, no, your duties will be commensurate with your pay, which is nothing. So once in a while, about twice, I believe, I've been asked to write Illinois poems for some special occasion. Once the sesquicentennial, and more recently, the for Illinois, more recently, the sesquicentennial for Chicago is starting its witnessing its celebration. in Chicago. So I was asked to write a poem.
You probably have a lot of young poets coming up to you asking you for advice or encouragement. Do you like to give very critical advice or supportive help?
Well, I do it. I get a lot of letters about the Poet Laureate honor. I decided to make an opportunity there. And I do want to tell you that I have a poetry competition of my own every spring. It starts in May. And I give 20 prizes out of my own pocketbook to young high schoolers and young elementary school students. And I thought that was as good a thing as any to do with that opportunity.
Are you involved in the women's movement at all, or do you consider yourself a feminist?
Well, I'm a woman. I haven't put any signs on my front or back, but I certainly favor ERA, and I favor many of the things that the feminists, as they like to call themselves, are doing. I met a good many of them, have appeared on panels with them, and I would like to say that I have a caution for black women because on some of those panels that I've joined white feminists on, I've noticed that many of them hate their men. They hate their fathers. I'm not speaking of everybody, but I've met so very many who hate their fathers, they hate their brothers, they hate anything that's male. And I've told black women, I mean, that's for white women if they choose that sort of solution. But I've told black women that cannot be their solution. It's another divisionary tactic for us. We are split 1,000 ways already. And we can't allow ourselves to be divided any further. We will have to find some way of managing life with men. We cannot throw our fathers in the dust. I should have said, because I'm a poet and must be alliterative sometimes, we cannot throw our daddies in the dustbin. And we must find some way to accommodate our sons. And if we have husbands, I know they can be the very dickens. I've had one for 43 years now. We did have a little vacation in there that proved instructive. But we'll have to find some way of working things out. That's what I tell black women.
You had mentioned that We Real Cool is your poem that's most anthologized. If you could choose one of your poems that you would like to appear in all the anthologies, if you had a choice of the poem of yours that everybody would know, which poem would that be?
I can't say that it is my favorite of all the thousands of poems that I have written over a very long, long career, as you can tell by looking at me. But a poem that I do like is The Life of Lincoln West, which speaks to the matter of identity. There is a way of liking in my race, liking what seems to be the sterling attribute or other of the overwhelmer. I'm not going to read it because it's too long. But I have a poem in this little book, Primer for Blacks, called To Those of My Sisters Who Kept Their Naturals. And underneath it I say, never to look a hot comb in the teeth. This is something of what I mean when I speak of identity. I was so happy when my sisters kept their naturals, those beautiful, powdery-looking naturals. You don't see too many these days. I couldn't believe it when they started straightening their hair again.
You actually hear a lot of ads now for hair relaxers, which is the term
yes,
that's used
now.
Yes,
you do. Uh-huh.
Can you read another couple of poems for us?
Well, if you have the time. About how much time may I allow?
About 4 minutes.
Then I'll read The Life of Lincoln West.
Great, good, good.
It's about a little boy who is not loved for his beauty. He has a wide mouth, a wide nose, and he has a very dark complexion. And although these attributes might make him a favorite in Ghana or Kenya or Tanzania, not in St. Louis. Ugliest little boy that everyone ever saw. That is what everyone said. Even to his mother, it was apparent. When the blue apron nurse came into the northeast end of the maternity ward, bearing his squeals and plump bottom, looped up in a scant receiving blanket, bending to pass the bundle carefully into the waiting mother hands, that this was no cute little ugliness, no sly baby waywardness, that was going to inch away, as would baby fat, baby curl, and baby spot rash, the pendulous lip, the branching ears, the eyes so wide and wild, the vague, unvibrant brown of the skin, and most disturbing, the great head. These components of that look bespoke the sure fiber, the deep grain. His father could not bear the sight of him. His mother high-piled her pretty dyed hair and put him among her hairpins, sweethearts, dance slippers, torn paper roses. He was not less than these. He was not more. As the little Lincoln grew uglily upward and out, he began to understand that something was wrong. His little ways of trying to please his father, the bringing of matches, the jumping aside at warning sound of oh so large and rushing stride, the smile that gave and gave and gave, unsuccessful. Even Christmases and Easters were spoiled. He would be sitting at the family feasting table, really delighting in the displays of mashed potatoes and the rich golden fat crust of the ham or the festive fowl, when he would look up and find somebody feeling indignant about him. What a pity, what a pity. No love for one so loving. The little Lincoln loved everybody. Ants, the changing caterpillar, his much-missing mother, his kindergarten teacher whose concern for him was composed of one part sympathy and two parts repulsion. The others ran up with their little drawings. He ran up with his. She tried to be as pleasant with him as with others, but it was difficult, for she was all pretty, all daintiness, all tiny vanilla, with blue eyes and fluffy sun hair. One afternoon, she saw him in the hall, looking bleak against the wall. It was strange, because the bell had long since rung, and no other child was in sight. Pity flooded her. She buttoned her gloves and suggested cheerfully that she walk him home.
She started out bravely, holding him by the hand, but she had not walked far before she regretted it. The little monkey, must everyone look? And clutching her hand like that, literally pinching it. At 7, the little Lincoln loved the brother and sister who moved next door, handsome, well-dressed, charitable often to him. They enjoyed him because he was resourceful, made up games, told stories. But when their more acceptable friends came, they turned their handsome backs on him. He hated himself for his feeling of well-being when with them, despite everything. He spent much time looking at himself in mirrors. What could be done? But there was no shrinking his head. There was no binding his ears. "Don't touch me," cried the little fairy-like being in the playground. Her name was Nerissa. The many children were playing tag, but when he caught her, she recoiled, jerked free, and ran. It was like all the rainbow that ever was going off forever. All the sparkling in the sunset west. One day, while he was yet 7, a thing happened. In the downtown movies with his mother, a white man in the seat beside him whispered loudly to a companion and pointed at the little link. "There, that's the kind I've been wanting to show you. One of the best examples of the species. Not like those deluded Negroes you see so much of on the streets these days, but the real thing. Black, ugly, and odd. You can see the savagery, the blunt blankness. That is the real thing." His mother, her hair had never looked so red around the dark brown velvet of her face, jumped up, shrieked, "Goda!" She did not finish. She yanked to his feet the little Lincoln, who was sitting there, staring in fascination at his assessor, at the author of his new idea. All the way home, he was happy. Of course, he had not liked the word ugly, but after all, should he not be used to that by now? What had struck him among words and meanings he could little understand was the phrase, the real thing. He didn't know quite why, but he liked that. He liked that very much. When he was hurt, too much stared at, too much left alone, he thought about that. He told himself, "After all, I'm the real thing." It comforted him.
Thanks so much for reading that, and thanks very much for being with us. It's been so enjoyable to meet you and to have you here.
Poet Gwendolyn, thank you.
Poet Gwendolyn Brooks has been my guest, and she'll be reading this evening at Bryn Mawr College at 8:30 in Goodhart Hall, and that reading will be free and open to the public. She is the Poet Laureate of Illinois, won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1950, and thanks again for being with us.